Okay, move out.
You're listening to the Valor Podcast with Nick Lehman, a show highlighting the people who defend the United States of America and those who support them.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Hello and welcome to the Valor Podcast. It's a new year and I'm excited. It's 2017. Who knew how fast 2016 was going to go? And really talk about time here is that 100 years goes by fast. Our country is 270 plus years old, but there's been a lot of things that have happened in that time frame. One of them is World War I. But first, let me get to our sponsors. One of our sponsors is the Hershey Miyamura Korean War Group. They're based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. They meet once a month, and it's a bunch of great Korean War veterans that get together, and they talk about old times and new times, and really, they're just there to help their brothers out. I've attended a couple of the meetings just as a guest, and I urge people that are that age to get involved in that group if they served in Korea, or if they know somebody, whether it's a grandpa, a grandma, or dad, get them out of the house. Get them to the Korean War group in your town. I promise they'll reconnect and get a spring in their step. So now we're joined with David DeYoung, who, by all accounts, has become a certified expert in World War I because he became best friends with one of the last living World War I veterans. And so, David, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
And so tell me a little bit about how you got involved with the World War I kind of history and your relationship with Mr. Buckles.
Certainly. I've got a background as a photojournalist. I've worked for the Grand Rapids Press and the Associated Press, and have a background in photographing and interviewing veterans. So I decided in 2007 to travel the nation and document the last World War I survivors. At the time, there were about 14 or 15 left, and I made it to 10, I believe. And Frank Buckles was one of them. And when I met him, I was incredibly impressed. He was like talking to somebody like Benjamin Franklin, had that much charisma and stature and history surrounding him. And we unveiled those portraits in the Pentagon with the Joint Chiefs. And after that event, got to know Frank a lot better in our effort for the memorial in Washington, D.C. And all the other veterans died, and it came down to Frank Buckles being the very last one. And he ended up being the last one in all the United States, and I believe the last one from the Western Front in the world.
And so I have experienced this too, that you meet veterans, and some of them, you know, they're in time, they pass through your lives, and it was a great moment. But it seems like you and Mr. Buckles kind of hit it off and became sort of lifelong friends on the back end of his life.
Yeah, we certainly did. I've got a background, like I said, in journalism, and I facilitated a lot of events and public relations here in Grand Rapids. And Mr. Buckles was becoming quite famous, to say the least. And after our Pentagon and White House visit, I could see he was going to become more famous. So I volunteered my time to help handle the facilitation of any of the meetings that would happen at his house, which there were hundreds of those people wanting to visit. And the family was cordial enough to accept the majority of those visits. So I facilitated those and then also handled the public relations for Mr. Buckles, which turned into be a huge undertaking. So in addition, the friendship grew. So times driving in cars together to Washington, D.C. for him to testify, and going to Arlington with him, and spending time with him on his farm in West Virginia, all pretty incredible times.
I bet those drives, I know you just sit there and you're just talking about life and things. Did you guys talk a lot about World War I and how, you know, kind of the veteran has really stayed the same, but warfare has changed over the years?
We did talk about World War One a lot because I produced a documentary on it and Frank Buckle's kind of adventures in the last years of his life called Pershing's Last Patriot, which is available on Amazon. And that's probably the last plug I'll give for it. But so we did talk about World War One. I spent some time knowing that he was going to age. I met him when he was 106, and I knew that I needed to record his story before it was lost forever, and put some HD video cameras on my charge card and multiple trips out there in the charge cards, and spent weeks with him talking about World War One and his life. So yeah, we did talk about World War One.
Yeah, one of the interesting facts that I saw is that, you know, it was the financial cost was $351 billion for all the countries that were involved. I mean, that's an astronomical amount of money back in that day. I mean, bread was like, what, like a nickel or something like that?
It was. And it's not only the cost, but America had essentially no military. The last major conflicts that we were involved with were the Indian Wars. So we did the Spanish-American War as well. But to think that America, with minimal military, created one and outfitted 5 million veterans in the time of 18 months, start to finish, is quite incredible.
And through your research, what kind of undertaking did our country go through? You know, I know a little bit about rations and you know, scraps and all that, but I mean, this is a foreign concept to my kids. You tell them, hey, you know, back in the day, there was a time where your grandparents or great grandparents had to ration gas, and they just kind of look at you like, what?
Yeah, there's really no comprehension in today's day and age. I mean, one of the other veterans that I interviewed was Harry Patch from England. And he was the last trench fighter, and he was involved in the Battle of Passchendaele, and that had 1 million deaths and casualties in that battle, which is far beyond comprehension. Now, on the state side, the question you asked, yeah, it was limit what you do with your food, limit what you do with your clothing, all of it, yeah, because World War One became this great sucking machine. It sucked lives out of people overseas, but it also sucked lives out of people here in the United States. Harry Richard Landis, who I interviewed in Florida as part of the project, was in training, I believe in Missouri, when World War One began and ended. And supplies were so lean then, they gave them broomsticks to practice their marching with. They didn't have guns.
I think that's probably why they call it the boomstick now.
Yes.
So you know, like you said, I mean, the human life, it was enormous. I mean, Vietnam was a big cost to our country, you know, financially and even with life. But you look at the human life lost in World War One. I mean, just research here that I saw, there was 17 million deaths and over 20 million wounded. That's a nasty, drag out fight, trench war.
It certainly was, and for what end? You know, that's a bigger question. Essentially, all it ended up doing was restructuring the lines of the nations. It did bring an end to the Ottoman Empire, which is interesting. If we talk about that, that would be a neat little sidebar. But for what end? What was the ultimate goal? It wasn't like we were fighting Adolf Hitler. People were just fighting to fight. So tragedy lost of the people.
And what kind of warfare was used back then? I mean, what type of things was being done to, you know, that obviously there was land that was being fought over and other things and other type of issues. But, you know, what are some weapons that they used? What are some, you know, facts that you came?
Yeah, that's really cool because it was a transitionary war between Civil War technology and modern warfare. So I boys this winter got the Battlefield 1, which is about World War I, and I can watch that with them and say, oh, yeah, so-and-so talked about that. Oh, yeah, one of those drove one of those. Oh, yeah, so on and so forth. But some of the technology that they used in the crossover, initially their ambulances were horse and like a horse and trailer. That was their initial ambulance. When Mr. Buckles became an ambulance driver, he drove, I believe, a White's ambulance, I think was the brand of it. But so that was the ambulance he drove. But since it was a transitionary war, they used horses for battle. The machine gun was introduced, and that led to massive slaughter. Gas obviously was used in World War I. It was the first time tanks were used. The Renault tank, I believe, seated two people. There's one of those on display in Kansas City at the World War I Museum and another at the 1st Division Museum in Chicago. And it's a really small tank. It's about the size of a Volkswagen, if that. So they used that, and the Germans introduced their tank. That went back and forth. And then, of course, air warfare began. So I also interviewed the last biplane pilot from World War I, Henry Allingham, in England. And we had a great discussion about the technology there. And he talked about, their method of communication. The very first, and I joke about this, the very first method of Twitter was he would be flying in the seat of the biplane, and they'd write down their notes of the battlefield, put it in a passenger pigeon, and release it from the cockpit while the plane was flying. And that would bring the intel back to headquarters. He also talked about holding bombs by hand. He'd sit in the back seat with a bushel basket between his knees and get over the Germans and basically be like, Guten Tag, here's a present for you, and drop a bomb by hand on the Germans. technology was fascinating.
Yeah, and in the infancy, that it just sounds crazy. You know, a biplane pilot holding a bomb in the lap of his cockpit, and it's like, okay, you're going to go out on a bombing mission today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's mind blowing, and the planes were quite archaic at that time because it wasn't much after the Wright brothers learned to fly.
And so why do you think that the modern warfighter sort of gets these technology advancements in combat? When you were interviewing these World War I guys, did they ever have, like, wow, we just got upgraded to, you know, what kind of equipment? Or was it just more of a, they were stuck in that time frame, and then, you know, the World War II came and more technology advances happened? I mean, what kind of technology advancements, besides the horse and carriage and going to the cars and the planes, did you gather from interviewing these World War I veterans?
Well, one of the other veterans I interviewed was Lloyd Brown from Maryland, and he was in the Navy. He talked about real ships were made of wood, not steel. So initially, a lot of the ships in World War I were made out of wood. So you've got that going for you. And then also he assisted in the capture of a German submarine, and they sailed that back to the United States to put it on display. And it could potentially be sunk about 35 miles from me right here, which is an interesting story. They brought a German World War I submarine, put it on display in Chicago. When the war was over, they had to destroy the enemy's weapons, so they brought it out into Lake Michigan and sunk it. So that's about straight out from where I am. Anyways, so he talked about boats being made of wood, and it was. It was just a complete advancement of all levels of it. Antonio Piero, who I interviewed up in Swampscott, Massachusetts, went over on a boat and had horses, and they trained their horses to speak French as they go. Not the horses didn't speak, but they trained them to respond to French. And that was part of his job as they traveled the boat ride to go to battle. So the horses started transitioning out, and more vehicles began transitioning in. And it was kind of the prototype for World War II. Of development of weapons, and that was World War I was greatly studied in the developments and battles of World War I, both technologically and advances in battle strategy.
And there's a whole bunch of pride to it. I know, like, the Marines, they're very, very fanatic about Bella Wood. You say Bella Wood, and, you know, the chest pops out, and they're like, that's where we got the nickname Devil Dog.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. That's like you said, that's one of the top references. And there are authors that have written good books on Bella Woods, and also expand out from there, from the Lost Battalion of World War One, and several other great stories. But yeah, it was a defining war. You know, obviously the Air Force didn't exist at that time, so they advanced and kind of emerged or evolved out of World War One to what we would have the Air Force today.
What kind of things that you, when you were interviewing all these World War One veterans, shared with you, like in terms of mementos that maybe a modern veteran would not have? Like, you know, we have email and text message and all the other things, and so I fear some of those letters home and things like that will get lost if they don't get printed out. But, you know, we come from a time back in the day where everybody wrote in a diary or, you know, wrote home.
Yeah, they certainly did. Frank Buckles kept some of his photos, and most of them didn't keep much of that, like you said. Frank Buckles himself didn't have that many letters. He did have some artifacts, which I've got a couple of them the family is kind enough to give me. So much of those letters disappeared. Much of the correspondence disappeared. And with that, much of the history, obviously it wasn't recorded orally because the technology wasn't quite there until later in life. So it was really a forgotten war on a massive level. And it continues to be forgotten because of the lack of recording letters and correspondence and audio, film, or video. If you go to the Library of Congress, which I worked with on the project, the Veterans History section, you'll have, you know, hundreds of thousands of World War II and other veterans. And last time I checked, which has been a few years, but World War I only had something like 8,000 or 10,000 maximum of stories in the Veterans History Project.
And you have kind of led the task and worked with people to get a World War I Memorial Commission off the ground. And I know there's been a lot of political panderings and of both sides. And so why do you think it's important for the U.S. to have a World War I Memorial?
Well, it's the lasting physical object to remind the world of our participation. So we fought very hard for that. The background of this is after we went to the Oval Office and the Pentagon, I asked Mr. Buckles if he would go to the National Mall with me and look for the World War I Memorial. My friend Chris Shear from the Department of Veterans Affairs told me, yeah, there is a World War I Memorial, and told me where it was. So we headed to the National Mall, and first we got a bit lost, and we saw the grandiose and absolutely well-deserved World War II Memorial. And since Mr. Buckles was involved in World War II as well, that meant something to him. So then we got our bearings straight again, and we headed back towards the Korean War Memorial, and located in the woods, an abandoned memorial to World War I. Now, the front of it says a memorial to the Great War. On the other side of the round memorial, it says to the District of Columbia. So initially, we didn't know it was a local memorial. And to the walk, or the person walking the National Mall, they'll look at it and see memorial to the Great War and think it's a national memorial. So we rolled Mr. Buckles' wheelchair in and out of the flagstone sidewalk, weaving him in and out. First one was impassable. Gustavo Rodriguez was our escort, and he's a career, and he just retired out of the Army. He eventually became President Obama's on the medical team that traveled with him. But so Gustavo was there. Susanna Buckles' Flanagan was there, and myself, and obviously Mr. Buckles. So we're weaving him in and out of this flagstone, approaching this memorial that was obviously in great decay and completely abandoned. So we arrive there, and there's algae covering it. There's pieces of the memorial falling off. There's one or two light bulbs in the dome that are illuminated. The marble clearly has not been cleaned for decades. The World War I seal in the center of the memorial had been stolen and replaced with a manhole cover. The grove of trees surrounding it that were honor trees were either cut down or removed completely on purpose. And Mr. Buckles asked at that point, would I help in the restoration of the memorial? And would I help try to find a way to create a national memorial to World War I on the National Mall? So I gave my word that I would do those two things. And that was almost 10 years ago. And we've continued to fight since then. And that led to the passage of a couple of laws signed by President Obama that were a direct result of that. And the story between those signed laws and that first visit to the memorial is pretty fascinating. One of the laws created the World War I Centennial Commission, and I was promised a spot on that, and I'm perfectly fine not being on it, so there's no bitterness because we've got different objectives. So the World War I Memorial was in there. The Centennial Commission was formed. They didn't ask me to be on the Centennial Commission primarily because I'm in opposition to their mission of locating a memorial downtown Washington, D.C. So we're obviously deeply involved in World War I, and I respect them. They respect me. We just have different missions. So the World War I Centennial Commission was formed. They passed a law to convert Pershing Park, which is a traffic island in downtown Washington, D.C., to the World War I Memorial. And that is a story that expands out, which is pretty interesting. And it's taken several turns for the worse.
It seems that this war should get equal treatment like the Korean Memorial, the Vietnam, the World War II. You know, I'm sure that there'll be a Iraq and Afghanistan and a global war on terror memorial. And it just seems like a sad poetic thing that it's going to be a kind of a traffic island and people just drive by and not even really understand what that's about.
Well, yeah. When Secretary of Defense Robert Gates spoke at our event in the Pentagon, he made due note of more people died in World War I than in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan combined. So 116,561 people from America died in World War I, and 4,734,991 served. So we fought very diligently, and Mr. Buckles fought diligently for the National Mall, and the original proposal was to restore the D.C. Memorial and simply share the location to make it the National and District of Columbia World War I Memorial. There's several acres, probably 10 acres surrounding that could have achieved this. Mr. Buckles became the oldest man in American history to testify when he testified at the age of 108 in front of Senate. So that was in process and going. You know, we met some political opposition to that. The World War I Centennial Commission is a powerhouse. They have the American Battle of Monuments Commission leading them. They have the VFW, the American Legion, and multiple other key groups that could certainly put a memorial where they choose. But they chose Pershing Park, the park in downtown D.C. And they got a law passed to do that. But they didn't do their due diligence for that location. And they held a national competition for design. I think around 100 architects spent their time creating concepts for the competition for the National World War I Memorial at Pershing Park. They selected a winner. That winner had a design that won, obviously. And then it came out that a year prior to that announcement, the World War I Centennial Commission actually knew that Pershing Park was going to be fully protected by being placed on the National Register of Historic Places. So that came out, and they attempted to maneuver around that, and that became an official proclamation. Therefore, Pershing Park essentially can't be touched or changed anything from the original architecture. And that, too, has fallen into disrepair because of abandonment. It was an 80s-era park, so it's not a classical-style park, so it's fairly 80s or semi-modern-looking. And that was one of the reasons they wanted to bulldoze it, because they just didn't like the way it looked and because it was left abandoned. So they planned to bulldoze it. Protective status came up. They selected a winner, announced the display, or announced the design to the world through press conferences, and began raising funds for it. Then the protected status came out, and they continued raising funds and are to this day for the concept of the winning design. Well, the latest design they've suggested, which most likely they won't have, is basically a 50 or 75 foot honor wall that would be in the base of the pond at the bottom of this traffic island. So you couldn't get, you know, you'd think there would be no worse possibility than a traffic island. And then you end up with a honoring wall that's supposed to honor 5 million veterans that's essentially submerged in this island that nobody's ever going to know about. So that's where they're at with it today.
How do we, as a nation, not forget about these wars? I mean, not that I have a fear that we would forget about, you know, the global war on terror, the, you know, Desert Storm, the, you know, the Panama and, you know, Vietnam and Korea and World War II and all those sort of conflicts and wars that have sort of a talking place at the table. It seems like as time goes on, the memory fades or the coolness of that era kind of fades as well.
It certainly does. If you look at the Civil War, that's in way distant memory. It's in way distant in the history books and history classes in school. And then you advance through the wars of the time. Nobody knows about the Spanish-American War, World War I. My kids are in school and they'll bring home their history book, and World War I will literally be like 6 pages out of the 20th century. World War II will be 40. So to keep the memory alive of all of these wars and the great sacrifice of those veterans, a cornerstone of that is to have a memorial, not only in Washington, D.C., but every town should have one. Albuquerque's got a great one. You've all got them out there. Albuquerque's great. One of your towns great. I'm trying to blank on the name, which is awful for me right now. But everybody's got one, and they need to have one on the National Mall. And if they don't have one, it should be created. You know, when I walked your memorial, it struck me because it was interactive. You got to see it. You got to walk around it. And as you walk through it, you understand and you got brought to a place of reflection. And if you don't get brought to a place of reflection, you generally won't have a place of remembering.
Yeah, that's a very good point. As you brought up, Albuquerque, where we broadcast at, has a Veterans Memorial Park, and I think it's over 40 plus acres of just peace and tranquility. It's amazing that you see all walks of life walking through those areas and looking and just kind of reflecting. And you hit the nail on the head with, you know, if we kind of forget if you're not going to reflect, then it's kind of a moot point for anybody to even consider, you know, saying thanks to a veteran or anything like that. Because if you can't remember these great men and women, then it's just kind of a lost cause for a country. I think that's just my own kind of thing that I think about often when I see these memorials.
Well, it certainly is. And for the modern millennials or upcoming people, they may walk through a park, but it won't have a personal touch to them because it's been so far removed, not only from history, but because warfare has transitioned. There is no way anyone from the modern era can comprehend going through rationing, going through the loss of hundreds of thousands of people, having enormous amount of veterans deployed in World War II overseas and being lost. There's just no comprehension for them on that. War has become very surgical, very clinical, and it's transformed greatly. With the advancement of drones, we're at war, and I believe they launch out or control out of Las Vegas. They go to their drone station, they do their job, drop bombs and eliminate enemies and go home for their supper with their family. So with that modern warfare, the comprehension of all the wars of the 20th century is quickly being lost in people's minds.
Definitely. And the thing that I look at during, you know, like Vietnam and Korea and World War II and World War I and even the Civil War is, I mean, the muster rolls of, you know, you'd have hundreds or even thousands a day that were being killed. And, you know, that today with the global war on terror, we've hit close to maybe 6,000, 7,000 service members that have given their life for our country. You know, they're all important, don't get me wrong, but you know, our society doesn't know the effects of losing 1,000 soldiers or, you know, 2,000 soldiers in a month. That's just unheard of, and probably we'll never hear of that unless it's a really, really bad time in America and in our country.
Oh yeah, certainly. You know what we've seen from the modern warfare? The modern war in Syria, I think, is fascinating because it does demonstrate to us that there can be large-scale wars involving the majority of a nation geographically and with people. So while wars have become very surgical, it shows and demonstrates that, you know what, as clean as war has become, quote-unquote, it still could revert back to something much more significant. And that brings us back to the Ottoman Empire of World War I. So the Ottoman Empire was the Turkish Empire that expanded and grew primarily from about 1054-ish A.D. to 1917 to 1918, when it began being dissolved. And the Ottoman Empire's footprint geographically, if you laid it over top of the Muslim extremists' blueprint of the region of today, is essentially the exact same thing as the Ottoman Empire's footprint. So with that and our sampling in Syria, that demonstrates there could be the ability for another significant war in the world's history, or in the world's future, sorry.
And yeah, definitely. I mean, what's the saying? History seems to always repeat itself, or, you know, something like that. And it's always on my mind on what other countries are doing and what could come of next. But so, you know, kind of wrapping this up, what are some takeaways that you want people to take away from World War One? You know, I know you sort of became the subject matter expert by doing all your projects and things, but if you have a few moments with people in passing, what do you wish to pass upon them before you depart from them?
Well, one of the things I, myself, and being the spokesman for the Buckles family, would want to let everyone know is it was never about Frank Buckles being the celebrity of World War One. It was about him being the representative of that generation. And if America had anybody else in that position, I don't know how it would have turned out, because Mr. Buckles seemed to be cultivated his entire life for the position, so to speak. So, one, it's not about Frank Buckles. It's about the other almost 5 million that served. It's about remembering the loss of the 100,000, and also as a demonstration of the great work of the American military from 100 years ago to modern day. It reminds us also of the tragedy of war. War is an awful, terrible thing that people can comprehend somewhat today because of those tight battles that we're involved in. But if we approach a massive war again, they'll understand it more. And it's a tragedy. And the final one would be, there is no memorial to World War One in Washington, D.C. And that is a direct result of the World War One Centennial Commission and even the World War One Museum in Kansas City. And that, I think, should be rectified. And it doesn't look like it ever will be.
And so finally, what can people do to carry on the legacy of World War One and help kind of maybe change the ideas of people to get a memorial and have a proper place for people to reflect and be, you know, educated about the war?
On the level of remembering World War One, I think it's very crucial for people to write and physically create, not just on a computer, but physically create memoirs of family members that were involved in all wars. Because there's going to come a time when if those veterans are living, they're not going to remember it. But that lineage gets passed down from generation to generation because of recording that. So to record it, if it's obviously World War One is not going to have the ability, but there are children of World War One veterans out there that could tell you the stories and even expand more than what I experienced with them, and record those, type them up, and keep them for future generations. So that's a big one. And then continue honoring them. And honoring them through a World War One memorial would be a great way. We fought that battle hard. Very hard. And I think I can honestly say that for an organization that had not one lobbyist, didn't receive any funding from public funds, didn't take a significant amount of donations to pass two laws towards the creation of a World War One memorial, I think was pretty good. And that comes as a result of Mr. Buckles being willing to go back and forth to D.C. So what can I do about a memorial now? Is that's tough. Certainly let the World War One Centennial Commission recognize that they could have the ability to fight for a proper memorial on the National Mall with the board members they have, because they've got an incredibly powerful board. That's primarily the big thing, and let the public know about it.
Well, David, thank you for joining us. This was a great kind of Cliff Notes version of World War One and your time with Mr. Buckles and other World War One veterans and sort of the idea of let's not forget our veterans, let's not forget our wars that we've went through. Thanks for listening to the Valor Podcast. Make sure to like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play or any podcast management app. Visit our website at thevalorpodcast.com. That's thevalorpodcast.com. Finally, find your mission. There are many veteran organizations, nonprofits, and veterans needing your help. I promise you'll make some great friends